Imagine this nightmare scenario. You've just imported a huge batch of custom steel parts from overseas. Crucial for your next big project, right? You're
Yeah.
feeling pretty good. Everything seems, on schedule. And then you open the boxes
Oh boy.
and it just hits you. The dimensional tolerances are completely off. Or maybe even worse, the material itself doesn't match the specs you painstakingly laid out.
Right.
And suddenly, that feeling of control just evaporates. You're looking at an entire project potentially spiraling, a
Yeah.
full-blown logistics nightmare.
It happens more often than people think.
Exactly. So this deep dive is all about turning that potential crisis into, well, a manageable process, equipping you with the knowledge to handle these kinds of situations when, not if, they pop up.
It's so true. Costly quality issues like that are a very real threat, to any project, especially with complex custom components like steel parts.
Definitely.
But you're right, it absolutely doesn't have to be a complete disaster. With the right systems in place, you really can protect your project.
So what are those systems?
Well, we're going to explore the core elements you need. Things like a clear return merchandise authorization or RMA process,
Okay.
robust documentation, rigorous quality inspections, and critically well-defined supplier agreements.
Right.
Our mission today, really, is to give you the insights to make returns and claims feel less like a fight, you know?
Yeah, less confrontational.
Exactly, more like an efficient, professional, and frankly, fair process for everyone involved.
Okay, so let's unpack this. A fundamental question to start. What makes a return policy truly fair? I was really struck by a story in one of our sources talking about exporters in Vietnam. They realized customers were hesitating on big orders because of that nagging, what if the quality is off
Yeah.
question.
Ah, yes. That really highlights the trust factor, doesn't it?
It really does. So what's the real purpose of a fair return policy? Maybe beyond just the legal stuff.
That trust factor is absolutely critical, yes. But fair return policy, it's the bedrock of that trust. And maybe the deeper insight is how meticulously defining things upfront, like return windows, eligible conditions, it doesn't just protect you legally, it subtly shifts the supplier's mindset, too.
How so?
It moves them from thinking if there's a problem to thinking, okay, when there's a problem, how do we efficiently resolve it together?
Ah, so it fosters a more proactive partnership.
Precisely, rather than a defensive one. A fair policy clearly defines conditions for acceptance, time frames, the necessary documentation, and specifies the remedies like replacement, refund, or maybe rework.
That makes perfect sense. So with that in mind, thinking about what makes a policy actually work in practice. What are some of those maybe less obvious elements that often get overlooked but turn out to be really critical?
Okay, good question. When we talk about the key elements of a fair return policy, several crucial points stand out, often missed ones.
Let's hear them. First, the return window. You have to be specific. Define the exact number of days after delivery that claims are accepted. Maybe 15, maybe 30 days.
Okay, nail it down.
Nail it down. Second, eligible conditions. Be strict. Limit returns to actual quality defects, incorrect specifications, or shipping damage, not just, I changed my mind.
Right, it has to be a valid reason.
Exactly. Third, documentation required. Mandate specific proof, like clear defect photos, batch numbers, or those crucial heat numbers for steel.
Heat numbers. Explain those quickly.
Sure. Heat numbers are unique identifiers for a specific production run or heat of steel. It traces the material right back to its origin. Super important.
Got it. Okay, what else?
And you need a formal inspection report. Fourth, the return method. Clearly state who pays for return freight and exactly how items should be shipped back. No ambiguity.
Right, who's responsible?
Fifth, the remedies. Clarify up front. Is it going to be a refund, a credit for next time, or will they rework the parts?
Set expectations.
Yes. And finally, a clear RMA procedure, a step-by-step process, and a specific contact point. Who do you call? What form do you fill out?
Makes sense. And here's what's often overlooked. This policy isn't just a suggestion you hope suppliers follow. It must be formally embedded. Put it right in your purchase contract or a dedicated supplier quality agreement.
So it's legally binding.
Exactly. This proactive step prevents so many misunderstandings down the line and sets crystal clear expectations before any issues even arise.
All right, so you've got this robust policy in place. Great. But then, an issue actually does come up.
It happens.
Yeah. I was thinking about that example you mentioned earlier, the U.S. customer sending just two blurry photos and saying, this isn't acceptable.
Right, the vague complaint.
It highlights how easily a claim can just get derailed, right? Even if the problem is real.
Yeah.
So what do suppliers actually need to see to take a claim seriously and act quickly.
That's a great example because it illustrates such a common pitfall. For a formal quality claim to move forward efficiently, you need way more than just a vague complaint. You absolutely must submit an RMA request that includes a detailed description of the defect, high-quality photos, specific batch and heat numbers, and ideally, official inspection results.
So specifics are everything.
I can't stress this enough.
Yeah.
Clear, comprehensive documentation is absolutely critical for validating any claim. Without it, you're basically just asking for a favor, not enforcing a contractual right.
Filing a quality claim, though, it can feel daunting, almost like you're starting a fight or a blame game.
It can feel that way, yes.
From your experience, what's maybe the single most common mistake people make when they first try to file a claim? And how can having a clear roadmap help them avoid that? What are the specific steps to file a quality claim?
A very common mistake is not acting swiftly or comprehensively enough. People send maybe one email, one photo, and kind of assume the supplier will just figure it out and fix it.
Right, sort of lobbing it over the fence.
Exactly. To avoid that, here are the practical steps. First, you need to notify the supplier promptly within that agreed claim period we talked about, maybe 7 to 15 days from receiving the goods.
Okay, act fast.
Act fast. Second, you must provide clear photos, not blurry ones. Photos of the defect itself, product labels, even the shipping package if it looks damaged or relevant.
Visual proof.
Yes. Third, submit copies of key documents. The material test certificate, the MTC, and your own receiving inspection report.
Okay.
Fourth, reference the key identifiers. The original purchase order number, the delivery date, and that crucial batch or heat number for traceability.
Connecting the dots.
Precisely. Fifth, describe the defect clearly. Don't just say it's wrong. Specify what's wrong. Is it a size deviation, a surface crack, the wrong grade of steel? Be specific.
Details matter.
Immensely. And crucially, sixth, keep the defective items segregated and intact. Don't use them. Don't alter them. Don't throw them away until the whole issue is fully resolved.
Okay, quarantine the evidence.
You got it. Preserve the evidence.
It really sounds like having a structured approach is key here. Thinking about that, what would a really good, comprehensive RMA claim form structure look like?
Yeah.
What are the non-negotiable fields that help organize all this efficiently?
You're right. Using a structured form is incredibly valuable. It keeps everyone organized. A good sample RMA form should absolutely include fields for.
Right.
The RMA number itself, once assigned, the original PO number, the specific defect type, the quantity affected, sections or links for attaching supporting files like those photos and reports, and clearly stating the requested remedy, what do you actually want them to do?
Okay.
And beyond just the form, using a centralized system, maybe software or even a shared log, for tracking all your RMAs and the communication back and forth, that significantly improves efficiency.
How so?
It provides an undeniable record. It minimizes that back and forth, the he said, she said. Everyone can refer to the same set of documented facts, which truly streamlines getting to a resolution.
That brings us perfectly to the next point, the indisputable power of evidence.
Yes. Crucial.
What often seems overlooked is that it's not just having proof, but the quality and specificity of that proof that really makes the difference.
Absolutely.
A vague claim, even if it's legitimate, kind of puts the burden of investigation onto your supplier.
Mm-hmm.
And that can erode their willingness to cooperate quickly.
Exactly. You're making them do your homework.
Right. So the real insight here seems to be robust evidence isn't just about winning a potential dispute. It's about making it easy for your supplier to agree with you and act swiftly.
You've absolutely hit the nail on the head there. Evidence is your strongest ally. To truly strengthen a quality claim, you need specific objective data, things we've touched on.
Like what specifically?
Like high-resolution photos that clearly show the issue. Precise measurement data use calipers, micrometers to quantify any deviations from the spec. Official test reports, especially for material verification.
The hard numbers.
The hard numbers. Photos of the packaging condition if you suspect transit damage. And of course, always include the affected part's heat or batch number to connect it directly back to that specific production run.
So when someone is actually gathering this evidence, maybe under pressure, what are the best types of supporting evidence they should really focus on collecting? The details you absolutely need in your arsenal to make it easy, as you said.
Okay, let's list them out clearly. High-resolution photos. Essential for visually demonstrating visible defects, scratches, cracks, deformation, rust, whatever it is.
Okay.
Dimensional inspection data. Use your quality control tools to validate any deviation from specified tolerances. This provides objective proof that it's out of spec.
Numbers don't lie.
Exactly. A spectrochemical test report. This analyzes the precise chemical makeup of the steel. It's critical, absolutely critical, to confirm material mismatches, leaves no room for doubt.
Definitive proof for materials.
Definitive. The heat number and MTC, material test certificate. These prove the direct link to the original steel batch, tracing the part right back to its source documentation.
Traceability again.
Always. A packaging condition photo. If the box arrived crushed or torn, document it. It highlights damage potentially caused by poor packing or rough handling during shipping.
Useful for freight claims too, maybe.
Potentially, yes. And operating condition notes. These can be important if the failure happened during normal use. Explain the context, it wasn't abused, it failed under expected load, etc.
Okay, what else? Any other evidence tips?
Yes, a couple more points.
Mm-hmm.
Always include your own inspection report from when you first received the goods, your goods in inspection.
Your initial check.
Your initial check. If you can get it, a third-party lab analysis adds huge weight independent verification and annotated drawings where you circle or point out the problem areas on the actual technical drawing. Invaluable.
Marking up the blueprint.
Yes. The more clearly and thoroughly you document the problem, the faster your supplier can understand it, validate it, and respond with effective corrective actions. This level of detail is especially vital if you're under tight production timelines. You just can't afford lengthy delays or rework cycles.
Makes total sense. Now, let's shift gears a bit towards the positive outcome, hopefully.
Right, the resolution.
I remember that example from the source material about a Chinese supplier who shipped a defective batch. But because a really clear quality clause was already in the contract,
yes,
a quick, relatively argument-free solution was reached. It really shows what's possible when you've done that prep work.
It's the ideal scenario, isn't it? And that's the key to skillful negotiation here. You need to rely on those clear contract clauses that define liability, spell out the available remedies, and detail who covers cost for rework, returns, or quality failures.
So the contract is your script.
It is. And your evidence at this stage becomes your strongest negotiation tool. It stops being about blame or opinions. It's about the facts measured against the agreed terms.
So when you're actually in that negotiation looking for a resolution, what are the different compensation options for defective parts that you should be aware of? What are the implications of each?
Yeah, there are several common ways this gets resolved, each with different implications. A credit note is pretty common. It's basically issued against future orders for the value of the defective parts. This works well if you have an ongoing relationship. It keeps cash flow sort of within the supply chain.
Right, keeps the relationship going.
Exactly. Then there's a partial refund. This is more direct actual cash reimbursement for specific losses you incurred. Straightforward, but maybe harder to get for minor issues.
Cash back.
Cash back. Sometimes the most efficient fix is free rework. The supplier takes the parts back, fixes them, or remanufactures them at no additional cost to you.
If time permits.
If time permits, that's key. Alternatively, a replacement shipment. They just send you a whole new batch, correctly made this time, without charge. This is often preferred if the parts are critical and rework isn't feasible or fast enough.
Get new ones.
Get new ones. And sometimes you might negotiate shared costs. Maybe you both split the return freight bill or the cost of a third-party inspection, especially if there's some ambiguity or just a desire from both sides to maintain the relationship smoothly.
A compromise.
A compromise, exactly. Now, for some tips for smooth compensation negotiation, number one, always stay factual. Avoid emotional responses. Lead with your evidence. Let the data do the talking.
Stick to the facts.
Stick to the facts. Consistently refer back to your agreed terms, the contract. Point to the quality warranty period, the definition of a defect you both agreed on, the response times they committed to.
Use the agreement.
Use the agreement. Propose realistic remedies. Sometimes demanding a full refund isn't practical or even necessary. Maybe a quick rework or a credit note is actually a better, faster solution for everyone.
Be pragmatic.
Be pragmatic. And don't hesitate to involve a neutral third-party inspector or even a mediator if you reach a genuine impasse. Sometimes that outside perspective helps break a deadlock.
Get help if needed.
Absolutely. And critically, keep everything in writing. Emails, documented phone call summaries, and especially any final signed agreements. Paper trails are essential.
Document everything. Got it. That's a really thorough breakdown. And it makes me wonder, going back to the contract preparation stage, when you're crafting those agreements, what must you absolutely ensure is covered in the warranty clauses? What are the real non-negotiables there?
Yes, the warranty clauses. The bare minimum, you're asking. Okay. They absolutely must specify the time limits for defect claims. For instance, maybe 12 months from delivery. A clear window.
Okay, the Bisley.
The deadline. They also need to clearly define the supplier's specific obligations. What exactly must they do if parts are defective? Rework, replace, refund, spell it out.
Their responsibility.
Their responsibility, and importantly, something often missed. Include your right to claim indirect costs if those defects cause knock-on delays in your own downstream production or assembly.
The consequential damages.
Exactly. Those can be huge, and you need the contractual right to potentially recoup them if the supplier's failure caused them.
That seems really important, but probably often overlooked.
Very often overlooked, yes.
Okay, so to sort of bring this all together for you, our listener, the core strategy we've been discussing here is really about being prepared. Define your return policy up front. Be meticulous about documenting any claims.
Meticulous is the word.
Gather strong, indisputable evidence, and then negotiate using the clear, agreed-upon terms of your contract. This whole systematic approach isn't just about managing problems when they happen. It's really how you stay in control of your supply chain no matter what pops up.
That's absolutely right. And when you manage quality claims systematically, like this, they really do transform. They stop being these constant crises that derail your project.
Yeah, putting out fires.
Right. And they become just another manageable part of your day-to-day supply chain operations. They become a process you follow, not a problem that catches you off guard every single time.
A process, not a problem.
Right.
I like that. Okay, now, something for you to maybe mull over after this. Consider not just the immediate, obvious cost of returns, but the much deeper, maybe hidden value of a meticulously managed supply chain. How does this kind of proactive preparation for potential quality issues, how does that fundamentally shift the risk profile of your entire operation?
Interesting question.
And maybe more importantly, what hidden opportunities does that create? Opportunities perhaps for building longer-term trust and creating truly robust, resilient partnerships with your suppliers.